Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, the Vatican joins the International Organization for Migration with a call to solidarity with the world's migrants. No Pirates of the Caribbean, the Church's action plan to prevent piracy on the open seas, and a peek down the chimney at Jolly Saint Nick. Just who was this Advent time saint? More than 215 million of the world's people live in a country other than the one they were born in, and their numbers are increasing every day. How do countries deal with this burgeoning issue? Well, shortly after World War II, in 1951 to be exact, 16 European countries formed the first Intergovernmental Committee for Migrants from Europe, forming the basis of what is known today as the International Organization for Migration. As the IOM celebrated its 60th anniversary, the Holy See, which has its own pontifical council for migrants, became a full member state of the global body on December 5, 2011. And that came with an appeal by Pope Benedict XVI for greater solidarity for the millions worldwide forced to leave their home countries.
Affido al Signore quanti, spesso forzatamente, debbono lasciare il proprio paese.
I entrust to the Lord those who often forcibly must leave their country or who are stateless, the Holy Father said. While I encourage solidarity with them, I pray for all those who are doing their utmost to protect and assist these brothers in emergency situations, exposing themselves to serious hardships and dangers.
Esponendosi anche a gravi fatiche e pericoli.
The Holy Father himself took notice of these anniversaries, and the reason, seems to me, lies in the fact that human mobility has been increasing enormously in the last few years.
The Holy See's permanent observer to the United Nations in Geneva, Archbishop Silvano Tomasi, explains why the Holy See felt it was so important to join the IOM.
We are talking of 215 million people living in a country different from where they were born. We are talking of 33 million refugees and forcibly displaced people of concern to the UNHCR. So the volume of people affected by either voluntary or forced mobility has just been increasing enormously. This fact affects countries in different ways. Countries of departure, countries of transit, and countries of arrival. In the end, the result is that migrations today have a transformative capacity. They change really societies. And this disturbs some people while it is seen as a blessing by others. So the issue is controversial, but nobody can deny the importance of these issues. First of all, new ethical questions are raised by, for example, the fact that so many people are dying and trying to cross from Mexico into the United States, from Northern Africa into Europe, from Somalia across the Red Sea into Yemen, and in other parts of the world the same phenomenon is taking place. How can the international community prevent so many deaths? Second point is that, for the point of view of the Catholic Church, there is a secular, century-old tradition of involvement with migration. There are religious communities that are working with migrants, like the Scalabrini Fathers and brothers. There is Jesuit Refugee Service that is dedicated to refugees. The International Catholic Migration Commission for over 50 years has been involved in this area of charity and service. And Caritas, at the national level, are carrying out several programs dealing directly with asylum seekers or migrants or refugees. So for all these reasons, the concern on the part of the Church and of the Holy See makes a lot of sense, because all these forces that are active on the ground need to be, in a way, coordinated or synchronized, so to say, with what other people are doing to make the service to the human person in need more effective. This is also part of the reason why the Holy See has decided to become full member of the International Organization for Migrations.
Archbishop Silvano Tomasi, the Holy See's permanent observer to the United Nations in Geneva. Weathering storms and enduring back-breaking work, that's often what many crew members can expect working in commercial shipping. But Somali pirates, with their dramatic attacks on ships off the coast of Somalia, have gripped headlines across the globe in recent years, raising the specter of other grave dangers to face industry seafarers and even holiday sailors. Well, piracy is nothing new. One just has to look at the 16th century French Saint Vincent de Paul, who was himself taken hostage by Barbary pirates on the Mediterranean. He was taken to Africa and sold into slavery.
Which echoes very much the situation of many seafarers who are passing through the Gulf of Aden. Their ships have been hijacked and kept for many months in quite appalling conditions, either on board their vessel or taken ashore.
These are no pirates of the Caribbean. Director of Development of the UK-based Catholic Apostleship of the Sea, John Green, points to some 450 pirate attacks in 2010 and nearly 2,000 people taken hostage. But in November, only six Somalis went on trial in France for piracy.
You could say relatively that's quite a small number for the number of ships that are passing through that area. And it's not only Somalia that's affected by piracy. There's off the coast of Somalia is the major area, but also off the west coast of Africa there's a lot of piracy too. At the moment there's probably about 400 seafarers being held by pirates, but there's probably about 100,000 seafarers each year passing through the Gulf of Aden. And you also need to remember their families back home who will be very worried about whether their fathers will be captured by pirates, their brothers, their uncles. So for a lot of people, the threat of piracy is quite a worry.
Have you come across any cases working there in the UK?
Just a couple of months ago, some of our volunteer ship visitors in South Wales, in Newport, went on board to visit a ship. And speaking to the crew, they mentioned that three voyages before, just a few months before, they'd been attacked by pirates. The pirates had come on board, so they locked themselves in the engine room for 2 days. And for some reason unbeknown to them, after 2 days, the pirates left the ship, which is quite unusual. But it was the first time that this crew had had the opportunity to share with anybody what their experiences was, how it had affected them, beyond insurers and other people coming to inspect the ship. They'd had nobody to share what their experience had been. So they were very grateful that the Apostleship of the Sea was able to get on board, offer them some support and some practical assistance, take them off the ship, get them to the shops.
I mean, it must be a traumatic experience for these seafarers. So a lot of psychological pressure, being held hostage for hours, maybe days, kidnapped. These pirates are asking huge sums of ransom.
Yes, it's not the popular idea of piracy that might have the idea of the Pirates of the Caribbean or Errol Flynn. It's really armed robbery, that somebody waving a machine gun will jump on board your ship, subject you to terror and to violence in order to threaten you, so that you can pass this fear back onto the ship-owning company. Ransoms they're demanding now are in the region of about £4 million, and a long period of protracted negotiations will go on, and often a ship will be, and its crew will be held hostage for months at a time. Recently an Italian cargo ship was released, and that had been captured in April, so they were held hostage for about 9 months.
I know you have a big outreach program. How does it actually work? I mean, especially dealing with these families who are traumatized.
At the moment of capture of a ship by pirates, it can be difficult for the families even to know what's going on. Has one of their relatives been involved? What's going to happen? So that information flow, it can be very difficult, and again, another source of worry for the families. So together with ship-owning companies, trade unions and other NGOs, the Apostleship of the Sea has been working with this consortium to put together a series of guides for families of seafarers, for seafarers themselves with this threat of piracy, and for ship-owning companies, how to prepare individuals for the threat of piracy, to see what it is, what is the context, is it likely to happen, and then how to manage themselves through this threat of piracy when an attack occurs. And this series of guides put together by this consortium called the Maritime Programme for Humanitarian Response to Piracy was launched in London. And Bishop Joseph here, the Secretary of the Pontifical Council of Migrants, came to London to really underline the Church's concern for all those within the industry affected by this scourge of piracy. So I think across the industry they were delighted that the Pontifical Council was present at that meeting, and the Church continues to be very much aware and involved with the lives of seafarers and all those affected by piracy, and how we can do something to mitigate it.
In fact, some of the things that the Pontifical Council for Migrants is calling for is they're appealing to governments and international organizations to activate channels to bring home these kidnapped seafarers. What are some of the other things that the Council and you and the Apostleship of the Sea are calling on governments and on shipping companies and everyone else involved to do?
The first thing I think with piracy really is to take the broad vision and see why does it occur in certain areas, particularly in Somalia, and because Somalia is essentially a failed state, why has piracy arisen in this area? There's various schools of thought. One is the contributory factors of overfishing in the area by international companies, reducing the amount of employment for local fishers there, the dumping of toxic waste, and looking together with ship owners, how can we reduce the possibility of attack? The most fail-safe way at the moment is to organise vessels to travel in convoy. No vessels have been attacked that have travelled in this way before, but also to try and find ways to better police the area with naval vessels. It's such a huge wide area, the Gulf of Aden and the Indian Ocean, it's quite difficult to do. But it is really to underline the necessity of collaboration between NGOs, governments, trade unions, who can work together to try and mitigate against this.
These shipping companies, are they encouraging their seafarers, their crew, to carry weapons now to protect themselves?
A number of governments have endorsed this. However, it's not clear that this is necessarily the best way forward for a seafarer to be living on board with an armed guard. Again, this can raise their own tension, their own stress on board. And it's not clear that the pirates, when they do attack a vessel, what sort of armaments will they have? Will an armed guard actually increase the violence in the course of the attack? So there may be other solutions rather than putting on an armed guard. That may be part of the response, but it remains to be seen if this is the best course forward.
Many countries do not permit ransoms to be paid when someone is kidnapped in order to dissuade people from trying to kidnap another person in the future. What is the Apostleship of the Sea's policy in that regard?
Well, what we see at the moment is that it remains national government's policy, by and large, not to pay ransoms. But shipping companies are doing it. They have a huge asset in the ship and also in their seafarers, tied up, not working whilst it's captured by pirates, and inevitably they continue to pay these ransoms.
One of the interesting things that I saw in some of the documentation is that young people, they're minors who are conducting these acts of piracy. Another thing is, I'd like to know who, I mean, are they getting their weapons through the ransom money?
It's an interesting fact of the Somali population, that half of the population of Somalia is under 16. Because of the very difficult situation of the country, the life expectancy there, I think, is in the late 30s or early 40s. And then when pirates are captured, from the point of international law, it becomes very difficult. How do you deal with somebody who's under 16? if you send them, release them and send them back to that country, the international community also has a duty of care to them, and you can't just release them back into the criminal fraternity back there. So it's very difficult. How, also from the point of view of a seafarer, what do you do when a 14, 15-year-old comes on board with a gun? It underlines the necessity of the international community to address the Somali lack of infrastructure and lack of government as the main root of the problem.
So what would you be urging international governments to be doing regarding Somalia?
To pay some attention to, whilst there is big problems in the world with the economic recession, we've seen that Somalia and what comes out of it, if we don't pay any attention to supporting the establishment of good governance there, the problems will continue to come out of it.
Yet the international community failed in the past to prevent civil war, to prevent the rise of Islamic extremism there in Somalia and so on. So, I mean, it does seem like the international community has kind of washed its hands of Somalia.
I think that Somalia is probably not the only place where that happens. But I think one good thing coming out of this is because it's affecting shipping, which everybody relies on, everything we wear, our living standards rely on many of the goods that come to us that are shipped. One figure says that between 7 and 12 billion pounds worth of economic trade is affected by piracy, that this puts great attention of the international community on what can we do to prevent piracy. And that brings us back to how can we address the situation of Somalia, this failed state? What can governments do? And we need to pay some attention to it, not only for how terrorists may end up on our own shores, but on how this affects the lives of seafarers and ultimately their families who may not be centre stage for international governments.
Another issue that we haven't talked about is that when international criminal organisations see how successful the Somali pirates have been, what is stopping them from also getting involved?
Well, we must remember that often pirates in Somalia and elsewhere, they're not an amateur organisation, they really are international organised crime, and behind this is a whole supply chain of where the money is going, where the money is coming from. And one needs to look also, for example, which international companies are supplying the engines, the outboard engines on the pirate skiffs, pirate boats. Where are these coming from? And are these companies that supply this, they're involved? They may be respectable international companies, but somehow they're involved in this piracy.
So, but I would assume indirectly, or are you saying more directly involved?
Well, indirectly, but do we need to hold to account all those organisations that even indirectly are involved in the supply chain of making piracy possible? In a country that's a failed state, we need to look at all the avenues of trying to prevent what is international organised crime and violence.
And a warm thanks there to John Green, Director of Development of the UK-based Catholic Apostleship of the Sea. The Church and Catholic families everywhere are celebrating Advent. But on December 6th, children, especially in northern European countries, focus on a very special feast day, the Feast of St. Nicholas. But just who was this 4th century saint, the patron of sailors and unwed women? Listen and you'll find out. One Christmas story most of us remember well, some even by heart, is the night before Christmas. And who can forget that image of jolly Saint Nick as he plopped down the chimney with his huge bag of toys and gifts?
He was dressed all in fur, from his head to his foot, and his clothes were all tarnished with ashes and soot. A bundle of toys he had flung on his back, and he looked like a peddler just opening his pack. His eyes, how they twinkled. His dimples, how merry. His cheeks were like roses. His nose like a cherry. His droll little mouth was drawn up like a bow. And the beard of his chin was as white as the snow. The stump of a pipe he held tight in his teeth. And the smoke it encircled his head like a wreath. He had a broad face and a little round belly that shook when he laughed like a bowl full of jelly.
That jolly Saint Nick was once the 4th century bishop of Myra in Asia Minor, known for his acts of piety and charity. He is said to have heard the story of 3 young girls whose destitute father was ready to set them on the streets as prostitutes because he could offer no dowry for them to marry. In the secrecy of the dark of night, Nicholas placed sacks of gold on their doorstep for each girl's dowry. Their father caught him in the act and overwhelmed him with gratitude. Under Roman persecution, Nicholas was thrown into prison for his faith. His relics are today found in the Italian port city of Bari, and he is known in the East as the patron saint of sailors. Yet here in the West, he is always remembered as the protector of children. Christmas time and December 6th are moments in which gifts are exchanged in his name.
And the children are very happy about this little prophet, which is bringing little gifts, not the ones they receive on Christmas, but small gifts on the 6th, bit of announcement of the Christmas time.
Lutheran Father Hans Michael Uhl is former pastor of the Lutheran Church here in Rome.
Also in the Lutheran world, the 6th of December is recorded a bit everywhere, especially in the families.
In Northern Europe, particularly in Germany, tradition holds that St. Nicholas comes this night with all sorts of simple goodies for children.
You get a lot of candies, tangerines, and nuts.
Enos remembers how excited she used to be trying to catch a peek of St. Nick putting goodies in her shoe on December 6th.
The night before, we all have to clean our shoes, that they are very clean. And then we put them in front of the door. And then the next morning, there were the candies inside.
In Germany, it's candy in your shoe, December 6th. In Italy, it's January 6th, when the Befana, the benevolent witch, brings sweets to all good children. Yet sometimes, with all these things to look forward to, we lose sight of the importance of Advent itself. How is Advent lived in the Lutheran Church, your church here in Rome?
I think for us in Italy, I find that there is the main time of Christmas is between Christmas and Epiphany. The Lutheran tradition is more from 1st of Advent until Christmas. So the 3 or 4 weeks before Christmas, we have a lot of preparing in the house, also singing and reciting verses and biblical lectures, but mostly singing and also the decoration, recording the birth of Christ and recording the feast which is coming.
Come on, everybody sit down. We're going to have our act. It's a tradition in my family, too, one which I've tried to pass down to my own children. What is this song, Sebastian?
Jingle bells.
Shall we sing it?
My parents, on the 1st December, it starts that we're celebrating every evening a little bit with stories and the candle. And then when the 4 candles are burning, there's Christmas. And we did it every evening, praying and singing and listening to stories about the Christmas time. It was something special because in the normal times we have had to go to bed, no stories or something like that. And at that time always stories, and mostly it took a little bit longer than in the normal time. And yes, the Advent calendar we opened, it was a kind of joy.
Do we say a prayer to baby Jesus?
Yes.
Because, you know, it's his birthday coming up soon. How old is he going to be?
Maybe like this, like me.
Four? 4 years old?
No, maybe two now.
Two? He's going to be 2 years old?
Okay. No, like that.
How old is that? Two. 10. 2. 5. 6. Okay. All right. So what do we say to baby Jesus?
These Christmas traditions of Advent preparation for the coming of the Christ child are too precious to let slide by the wayside. They help fortify our children in the faith and instill in them confidence in God's goodness and a sense of charity. In these frenetic times, they can become an oasis of family closeness, a moment of reflection on what is truly important in our lives. Sometimes it is the greatest of things, a small hand taking yours, soft words of joy and expectation for baby Jesus' birthday. But sometimes it is the smallest of things, a tangerine or a handful of walnuts in a shoe left by Saint Nick.
Finger aside of his nose, and giving a nod up the chimney he rose. He sprang to his sleigh, to his team gave a whistle, and away they all flew like the down of a thistle. But I heard him exclaim, ere he drove out of sight, "Happy Christmas to all, and to all a good night."
Well, that brings today's program to a close. I'm Tracy McClure, thanking you for joining me for the last half hour. Tune in again tomorrow at the same time and on this same channel for the next English feature program, or you can hear us at any time of the day or night by clicking on our website. That's vaticanradio.org. Just look for the English service. We'd also love to hear your comments or suggestions, so send us an email. We appreciate snail mail, too. Just send us a note to the English Service at Vatican Radio, Piazza Pia 3, Vatican City, 00120. Again, thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.